Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The need for social distancing has accelerated the demand for robotic technology to replace humans in the workforce, from sorting and stocking on grocery shelves to swabbing the floors. So how is that going to work? It depends, according to Richard Pack. He's a professor of psychology and director of the Clemson University Human Factors Institute and co-editor of the new book, Living with Robots. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
This is in the news now because there's been an increased demand for it, but you research and study how humans relate to automated technology. It feels like it's sort of being thrust on us now. Is that a good way to go about this?
It definitely is not because, first of all, I think a lot of people have this misconception that humans can easily be replaced with robots or other forms of automated technology. But if your listeners dig a little bit deeper, they'll see that it's actually really hard to do. Examples where we do see humans being replaced by robots, those are tasks that are extremely simple or extremely boring or extremely dangerous.
Those seem like very disparate reasons.
It all has to do with robot capabilities. So, we see movies and TV shows like Westworld that make it appear that robots are, much more advanced than they actually are. They actually are limited in their capabilities to doing very simple, extremely well-defined tasks. And so whenever humans are in occupations where the task parameters are extremely well-defined or highly repetitive, those are situations where robots can easily take over.
What do people distrust the most about robots?
I think it's that, this is a talk. It's certainly a psychological topic, but it's one that I don't study. But it's this fear that they will take over, right? That they will take over our occupations, that they will, some of it's still by fiction, that they will rebel against us. But fortunately, due to technical limitations, we're not even close to that situation just yet.
No, we're not. But it makes me wonder when we do think about things like Westworld or that other. There's a series out of UK called Humans. We've collectively been writing about robots for decades now, and what they mean. Is it the fear? Is it a function of this fiction about them, at least as we know it now?
I think it's that, but I also think it has to do with their appearance, right? Because in many examples that we see of robots, they appear human, and even when they don't, they seem to have these human characteristics. And to be quite, sort of blunt about it, they creep us out, because even though they might appear human, they certainly don't act human. And I think that disconnect really unnerves a lot of people, layering that on top of all the other fears that we have about this.
A lot of people think robotics is about, humanoid type of contraptions, but most of the stuff that we're using as robots in manufacturing and stuff, they may have arms to them, but they're nothing human about them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a little bit of a sort of a gray area that we're not quite sure what to do about, because is it beneficial to make robots appear human? And by appear human, I don't literally mean like Westworld androids, but I mean like, giving them two arms and giving them a screen for a head, versus should we not do that? And some companies, I think a lot of commercial companies, are deliberately making robots appear non-human because they think then people won't feel threatened. But then there's a whole other side of people that say, maybe we should, and I'm on this side, that maybe we should figure out, what lubricates the relationship between humans and robots. What is it about their appearance, and can we use it to sort of allay their fears, enhance the adoption of robots? So can we sort of study what is it about the appearance of robots that creeps people out, maybe don't put that in. Or what is it about the appearance of robots that makes people feel comfortable and put that in? A good example is on your website, you have a picture of the Marty, the floor cleaning robot.
Right.
It has two big, googly, friendly-looking eyes. They serve no function, but it reduces anxiety, right? They serve absolutely no function. There's no sensors behind that. It's just to make it appear friendly.
Does how we react to robots have anything to do with where we come from, how we live, our socioeconomic level, that kind of a thing?
I think so. I definitely think so. I think there's a lot of factors that sort of moderate how different groups of people perceive robots. And you mentioned a bunch of good ones. Some other things might be, the social position of the robot compared to you. Is it a subordinate or is it an equal? Or is it, in the workplace, is it considered an equal? Your education level, your experience level with technology, and even some things as like your age, that has an effect.
And in what way? What does age have to do with it?
So, age is obviously correlated with familiarity with technology, right? And if you're familiar with technology, you know that this entity or this thing might not harm you, so you're less afraid of it. Whereas maybe people who are older and might have a little bit less experience with this new technology, they can't properly calibrate their expectations, right? They don't really know what its intentions are or what it could do. So they might be more hesitant and afraid of it.
Oh, let's see. Debbie in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I had an interesting conversation with my 4 and 6-year-old great nieces a couple of weeks ago. They wanted Alexa to play a song for me to hear it. And I said, girls, you know that Alexa is not a real person, right? You know that it's a computer. And they looked at me like I was crazy. And we had about a 5-minute dialogue where it was very clear to me that they had no idea what I was talking about. So I was just horrified. And then we proceeded to watch a cartoon that humanized, it's a very popular cartoon, humanized all the computers. The entire cartoon, they were all robots and computers. And
so is this a plot to take over the world?
Well, I was just blown away. So I'd like to hear dialogue about this because it actually scared me. I came home and told my husband and told some friends, these 4-year-olds and 6-year-olds think that these are, and also the cartoon had the robots crying and being hurt and being happy and being helpful. It was, So why don't you guys talk about the plot?
Well, I'm just thinking, you got me thinking, about Rosie from the Jetsons now. I'm getting all kind of, misty-eyed about this. So thanks, Debbie. But Richard Pack, what about that? I mean, why do we do that?
So, it's an interesting contrast, right? Because, we as adults are absolutely horrified by that because it seems like kids can't get the distinction that there's nothing living or sort of sentient behind this stuff, right? But that's really a horror that exists in adulthood, right? Because with kids, it doesn't really matter. And I'm definitely not discounting your fear or concern, because I think it is a fear. It's a legitimate fear or concern. And it's almost a sort of one that exists in our modern times. But, a lot of work going on in a subfield of sort of this area called social robotics is all about sort of figuring out how can we sort of use how humans perceive other humans. When we see a smile, we assume friendliness. When we see a frown, we assume malevolent intent. Can we give robots that capability, again, in the service of sort of smoothing out relations between humans and robots? Because, you definitely don't want to be fearful of robots because they're there. They might even be in your workplace. So you might as well, use it to help you do your job, right? And so the ways that we can alleviate that anxiety and fear are by giving it, fake emotions or fake facial expressions.
which is on one end of the continuum, and the other side is making them nothing at all recognizable, except in so much as they need to do the job.
Yeah, the very interesting thing, though, is we as humans, even if you gave me a shiny black box, I'm going to anthropomorphize, which is I'm going to give it some human characteristics, whether it was designed to accept them or not. So we do this with our computers and cars, right? Like some people name their cars, or some people talk to their computer, they get angry at it. They think the computer is trying to sabotage them, when in fact it's just this rectangular piece of glass in front of you, right? So, you know, humans do it anyway. And so shouldn't we as researchers and designers, try to control how they do it so that they don't do it just maladaptive?
Debbie, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Your research shows that humans and automation function better when they work in collaboration. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so there's actually some interesting research out there. It wasn't done by me, but that showed that. So they sort of had three groups. They had, and I might be making this part up, but they had like doctors look at radiological X-ray images and sort of assess their accuracy. Then they had really advanced AI that was trained to do that thing. And then they had a third group where doctors worked with the AI, and it was that group where AI and doctors worked together, radiologists worked together, where accuracy was best. And so that's sort of AI by itself performed the worst. Doctors, radiologists performed second best, and the best performing group of the three was when they worked together.
Some people are afraid that whenever they're working with AI or robotics, that this has a lot more to do with AI than anything, I suppose, but that they're always being the trainer. They're training the AI to get better eventually.
And that's definitely true, fortunately for the foreseeable future as well, because right now it's sort of, you know, the capabilities and limitations of AI are really determined by the data that we feed it, right? And which actually leads to a lot of the problems that it has. But I'd certainly rather be in that position than AI sort of, I think they're probably getting to it, but AI training itself, then we have no idea what it's learning or what sort of data it's using.
And is it wrong to, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, combine AI and robotics. There's two separate things. I mean, Alexa doesn't go anywhere, doesn't really do anything except when we ask for information or to play a song or something. But I mean, should we combine them in our thoughts when we think about robots?
You could think of those two examples as sort of on different areas of the spectrum.
Okay.
You know, there are examples of, you know, AI is sort of this disembodied thing that exists in technology. It might talk to you like Siri or Alexa, which might be rudimentary forms of AI, or robots, which are sort of this mobile sort of platform, right? And they may or may not contain AI. And there are certainly examples where researchers and scientists have combined them, right? So AI that or robots that are mobile, but that have, you know, AI built in. So they're more advanced than, say, for example, a factory assembly robot, which is designed to do one thing repetitively and it can't handle anything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots to talk about. Richard Pack, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Richard Pack is a professor of psychology and director of Clemson University's Human Factors Institute. He's co-editor of the new book, Living with Robots. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple and Google have announced plans to work together to track the spread of COVID-19 using phone data, Bluetooth technology, and apps from health organizations. The American Civil Liberties Union has raised a red flag, however, over concerns that any such program be limited to avoid compromising user privacy. Addie Robertson is a senior reporter for The Verge. She covers tech policy. She's been covering this issue. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So the Apple and Google, they're going to roll out the new technology in two stages beginning next month. Participation will be voluntary, and users would download an app to join it. First of all, how unusual is it for rivals of this nature to collaborate in this way?
It's really a big step. It's a big step, especially for them to work together on a system that's a basic feature of the phone eventually. And so it's a pretty extraordinary project if it works.
Why do they need each other?
Because the whole point of, so this system, it's a contact tracing system, and the idea is that you're supposed to be able to figure out if you've been in contact with anyone who has been diagnosed with COVID-19, and the system really only works if you have a lot of people on it. If you break the links in the network because you have an iPhone and the person next to you has an Android phone, then the system becomes just so much less effective. And so they need something that is both very, very easy to use and very common, and something that is going to work on all their phones.
So all the phones would be communicating with each other?
If you opt in.
And is it opt-in? Is that a proactive thing you have to do, or do you have to check a box saying you're opting out? It's an opt-in for sure.
It's opt-in. So the, like you mentioned, there are two phases. The first phase is a system where you have to actually download an app. They're going to try to make sure that it's interoperable so it works no matter what phone you have, but you have to proactively take that step. Then after that, they're going to, in some fashion, build it in as a basic feature of the phone. And that would still be opt-in. You would go to presumably your settings and you would turn this on, but it would be much more strongly encouraged and much easier to turn on.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Verge reporter Addie Robertson about plans by Google and Apple to work together to track the spread of COVID-19 using phone data, Bluetooth technology, and apps from health organizations. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Someone infected, if they opt in, would have to be willing to disclose that through the app, right?
Right. And obviously, Apple and Google don't want someone who is a hypochondriac or a troll to be claiming that they're infected. And so this system is supposed to be run through health agencies. So there's going to be some validation of whether you actually have been diagnosed, and you also have to proactively share the data.
Would this be like the wellness app that I use through Ohio State University? Would it be an organization like that that is working with them?
It could be. There are still a lot of details up in the air because this has really only been in the works for a few weeks. And so a lot of this announcement seems to have been just laying the groundwork to get people talking about this while they're working with health agencies and security people and anyone else who's going to need input into this.
If I've been exposed to COVID-19, what are they thinking? What are they imagining that the phone would, how would it would alert me?
So in either system, the idea is that you would get a pop-up and it says, hey, you've been exposed. If it's the app section, then like the first phase, then you've already downloaded this app and it can give you more instructions. It can tell you, okay, maybe you should self-quarantine. Here are guidelines. In the second phase, then as far as we know, it's going to alert you even if you don't have an app installed. But if you want more details, it's going to prompt you to install something. So it's still going to warn you. But you'll still need to take that next step somewhere outside the operating system.
I'm trying to figure out how this works, though, because people who have been infected with COVID-19, who have COVID-19, they're not supposed to be out and about. They're supposed to be quarantined.
So the idea is that one of the really bad things about COVID-19 is that it takes several days to manifest. So if you're showing symptoms now, you may have been infected up to 14 days ago and you've just been walking around shedding virus.
Mm-hmm.
And so the goal is that people use this before they get infected. You turn this on, and as you're walking around, your phone is trading keys with people that you're within 6 feet of. And then if you end up feeling sick and you go get tested, you turn on a setting through your health provider or whatever system they work with, and it looks through, it finds all the keys of the people you've interacted with, and then it warns them that, hey, sometime in the last week or two, you were exposed to someone who was possibly contagious.
Okay. All right. And what is the ACLU worried about?
So the ACLU's concerns are sort of general and twofold. The first is that, obviously, that any system that tracks you in any way is going to raise some kind of privacy concerns. Apple and Google have actually taken unusually strong steps to try to make sure that it is private. They have a system that, first of all, does not track location in the way that you would expect from, say, a GPS-based system, and also goes to pretty great lengths to anonymize the data. So insofar as you can make a tracking system anonymous, it's relatively close. The second concern is just that it doesn't actually work that well, that this is contingent on, A, a lot of people turning this setting on, B, Bluetooth actually being able to accurately determine when you're within range of somebody and accurately convey that information to you, and also there just being enough tests. Apple and Google can't ramp up the number of people who are getting tested in, say, the U.S., where the fact that we just don't know who's infected has been a massive problem.
Right. That's what I was thinking, was we don't even have it's ridiculous how few tests there have been in Ohio alone.
Right. So this is one of the big criticisms of this, is that it sounds like a really big step, and it is on a sort of theoretical level, but it depends on so many other factors that it might end up not being actually that helpful. And Apple and Google definitely don't want it to replace the more old-fashioned methods of contact tracing, where you interview somebody and you ask, hey, who have you been dealing with?
Then why are they doing this?
So the goal is that this could fill a gap in that system. So with contact tracing, you typically talk about everyone you've gone and met with, if you met up with a friend, if you visited family. But if you were just on the subway with someone whose name you don't know, you have no way of really telling them that you interacted with them. And so this fills that gap where if you are close to someone who you don't know, then it can alert those people and sort of expand the range of contact tracing.
What's in it for Apple and Google?
On an incredibly broad sense, the fact that they want the economy to recover as much as anyone else.
Okay.
On a more basic level, they want to fill a health need. If they can do something that makes their phones more useful to people, then that's good for them.
How is the scientific community responding to this? What sort of feedback have you gotten from health organizations, for example?
Health organizations seem to be they're willing to try basically anything that seems like it could work or help people. The experts have been a little bit ambivalent on how good Bluetooth-based contact tracing is going to be. But some of the problems have been that, hey, if you have to install an app, nobody's going to use this thing. And so there's a little bit more optimism that if these phone makers basically build it into their app, into their operating systems, that helps one of the really big problems with it.
If they build it into their operating system, though, is it still something you'd have to opt into?
It is, but it's much easier for them to, say, prompt somebody to opt in. They can make people aware that it is an option on their phones, whereas if you have to install an app, you may just absolutely not know that this thing exists.
And who would be monitoring the information? Is this where the hospitals or the government comes in?
This is one of the things that's really up in the air and that's incredibly important to nail down over the next few weeks, is that, yes, you're supposed to have a system that is extremely secure, probably run by Apple and Google to some extent, but anonymized in a way that it's very, very difficult for anyone to, say, identify an individual person. And a lot of the processing and sort of information just gets stored on people's phones, and it's just it's sort of sending pings that are not, that companies like Apple and Google can't really track down and look for. And then governments are probably going to play a role in this. Apple and Google have partnered with the CDC and other groups before. So this is an issue where it's going to be incredibly complex, and they're going to have to reveal a lot more information to really help people understand what's going on.
And how have they responded to the concerns from the ACLU?
It really is hard to overstate the lengths that they've gone to explain how this isn't a privacy issue. So while they may end up still clashing with them, they've sort of preemptively responded pretty elaborately and comprehensively.
And the ACLU is nonplussed? What?
The ACLU is still, I think, sort of feeling things out, that they're open, they appreciate that Apple and Google are taking these steps, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Okay, well, Addie Robertson, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Addie Robertson. She is a senior reporter covering tech policy for The Verge. She's been covering plans by Apple and Google to work together to track the spread of COVID-19. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More tech news coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We've been talking about plans by Google and Apple to work on tracking COVID-19. I'm interested in getting some feedback from our regular guest, Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
So I thought that Addie Robertson kind of summed it up, you know, and I said, well, why would they be doing this? What's in it for them? There was a pregnant pause, and she said, well, I think they just really want to get the economy going again, and they figure if people can track it this way, it might help. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's certainly a significant part of this, but it's also important to keep in mind that what Google and Apple have in mind is not just a long-term plan. It's something that can be, you know, kind of deployed over and over again. You know, this is something that isn't just applying to, you know, this one very specific case. And that's kind of the larger play there. When it comes to medical data, Apple and Google have been trying to be, you know, kind of dominant forces in the medical industry for 5 years now. You see that with the Apple Watch and you know, Google's move to make a lot of its services available to discount for healthcare providers. So, you know, this is a, you know, kind of a mutually beneficial thing for both of these companies in that it gets, you know, it gets people front and center with in the UK, you know, the National Health Service and then all of the different organizations that are responsible for healthcare in the U.S.
Right. It's easier in European countries where there's mostly one healthcare provider. Here it requires a lot more coordination. I'm wondering, are they, you know, if they are they rolling it out in the U.S. first, you know?
It will most likely be a U.S. rollout initially, although the National Health Service in the U.K. did step up immediately and say that they were willing to work with Google and Apple to do as much as possible. So I don't imagine if there's a significant lag between the two countries that it'll be, you know, due to anything other than, you know, trying to get it to be up and running in a functional way in the U.S. You know, obviously the biggest concern from a lot of folks when it comes to this is privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding exactly how all of this works. And that's something that the UK has been taking very seriously over the last year. with some of its policies too. So you know, the mechanics of how this is going to work are you know, going to be, I think, the biggest challenge.
Yeah, I almost wonder, well, I mean, in real time, how soon they can actually roll it out. And I'm also wondering what your thoughts are about how people will take to this. Do you think it's like everything else? It'll be incremental, and then all of a sudden people go, what difference does it make? They already know everything else about me.
I definitely think that there are going to be, you know, more than a couple of people who are going to take that approach. You know, well, you know, everyone already knows everything about me. I might as well share this information too, especially if it, you know, benefits you in some kind of tangible way, like you're seeing here with having this information readily available. What I will say is that, you know, there's a big push from Apple to make this as secure and you know, personally private as possible. And a big way that is happening is through, you know, making the service opt-in, making it Bluetooth only, so that you're only really getting information from someone who's in your immediate sphere of influence, and not using GPS information, which can be recorded by multiple parties. You know, so there's a lot of steps being taken just in the initial rollout of how they want this to work that make it clear that this is something Apple and Google are working together to keep away from organizations that would try and just harvest as much data as possible to build a map of, you know, where you've been and what you've done. But on the other hand, that's kind of what's necessary in this situation if you want to know where someone who has COVID-19 has been over the last, say, you know, 5 days. You know, having access to that information is tremendously valuable right now. You know, so being able to balance personal privacy and obviously human rights is a tremendous challenge that Apple and Google are going to have to be very, very clear about how this works, and then have it not ever, you know, not ever do something other than what they intended.
So I'm thinking, trying to visualize this, I get a ping from whoever telling me that was exposed 6 days ago to somebody who now has COVID-19. What are the expectations for me then? Am I going to get tested for it and then report back that I have it or I don't have it, or what?
So those details are still, you know, not really being worked out. But the way that this is, similar versions of this exist in China right now. And in South Korea, and what we've seen through contact sharing is not different from what you've just described, you know, where someone can go and say, hey, I was just tested and I was found positive with this thing. And it reaches back into the contacts and says, okay, so in the last, you know, 5 days, you've interacted with, you know, this, you know, group of 75 people. Those 75 people get a notification saying, hey, you've been exposed to this person. As to what the next steps are, I suspect here in the U.S. we'll see you know, ways to go to a testing center and be, you know, kind of on an escalated list, you know, to some sort of priority to go and get tested immediately because you know that you've been in contact with someone who has been confirmed to have it, you know, and so you'll probably end up seeing a lot of that here in the U.S. The rest of the arrangements, you know, especially with the National Health Service in the U.K., it's not super clear how that's going to work.
Okay, well, I guess we'll follow up with that as things, you know, as the world turns. TV viewing and streaming is way up while Americans sit out the COVID-19 pandemic. And that's been good news for the folks at Disney Plus. I think this is really interesting. They launched just 5 years ago, 5 months ago, and already have 50 million paid subscribers. Now, they did really well right at the outset, did they not? Because of just the way they marketed it and so forth. But wow. I mean, can you put that into context with other streaming services?
Sure. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Disney Plus had an explosive, you know, first couple of months when it started out, not just because, you know, it's all of this incredible nostalgic Disney content, but then also, you know, some really powerful out-of-the-gate launch with The Mandalorian being as successful as it was. And then really just, you know, everyone's stuck at home, so they need things to watch right now. So it ends up making a lot of sense. But also, you know, Verizon and several other places offered, you know, a free year of service as a part of a deal with, you know, by having a Verizon subscription, and I think T-Mobile is doing something similar. So there have been a couple of avenues where you are technically a paid subscriber, but, you know, it's because you're getting it as kind of a sweetheart deal through something else that you pay for. And that'll go away after a year. So we may see some things there. But as far as context goes, Netflix, in the first quarter of 2020, revealed that they had 171 million subscribers.
Okay.
So for something to be almost a third as popular as Netflix within 5 months of it being in existence is phenomenal.
Right. And it's expanding the service too, right?
You know, Disney is constantly working to put new things into Disney Plus, you know, just earlier this week. And I know this because I have an obsession with this particular genre of show. They launched a new show that's a cooking show, where the winners get to go on a Disney cruise, which I kind of feel bad for whoever won that. We don't know who won that yet.
Bonk.
But presumably, this was filmed several months ago, and so now they're like, wow, you know, about that Disney cruise that I won. It's kind of a bummer. But yeah, so there's a constant rollout of both new shows and you know, different content deals that Disney's made. Especially as it rolls in the acquisition of Fox and you know, some of the other, you know, content that comes from that. But also, you know, with no one going to theaters right now, Disney was able to take its very popular movie Onward, which was only halfway through its theatrical premiere when COVID-19 happened, and actually put it on the service for free for people to watch after it was available to rent for a week. And that was tremendously successful as well. So, you know, Disney is able to explore a lot of different options with this service right now and things that it probably would have taken its time to test, you know, over, you know, maybe a year or two. It now is in this, you know, it has a captive audience. So it can kind of test things in a much faster period.
Is Disney's subscription ongoing, or do you have to renew it every year?
Disney subscription is monthly for most people.
Okay.
There were deals initially where you could pay for a 3-month subscription and get a discount, or you could pay for a year up front and get a discount, or you could bundle it with Hulu and ESPN Plus if you were excited about having, you know, kind of live TV through something other than a cable provider, and then obviously a sports package to go along with it. You know, to put all of those things together, you know, essentially creates a streaming package that comes pretty close to being like a cable package. But for a couple bucks less. And so that's been something that Disney's leaned on, especially in the last couple months.
When's Mandalorian getting the next season out?
Wouldn't that be great to know? That's
yes.
The kind of thing that, like, with a whole bunch of people stuck at home, you should drop a trailer for season 2, like, right now.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, it's been a while now. And
like, we're done with Tiger King. We need to go back into Star Wars for a little while.
Did you watch Tiger King?
Yes.
I still haven't.
You still haven't.
I know.
Well, that's probably a good thing. You deal with a lot of things every day that probably make you less than happy, and watching that is not. But we don't walk away from Tiger King smiling. So that's probably
all right.
Thing.
Okay, good to know. I had no idea. All right, Twitch watch parties. Amazon Prime's come up with a way to let people watch movies together. So this isn't, we know Twitch from gaming, right? Not movie
that's
watching.
Right. Well, Twitch has been a popular game streaming service. It is the most popular game streaming service. And one of the things that has made it popular is being able to watch with friends. You have someone who is game streaming. You can all kind of join in a chat together and you know, share some thoughts and communicate with the person who's playing the game. They're trying to apply that logic to watching shows together, which is very useful right now, in that everyone can start, you know, playing whatever the thing on Amazon Prime now is, at the same time, you know, someone has control over play and pause, so everyone is synced up. You're all watching, you know, the same thing at the same time. You can all react to things at the same time. And the whole idea behind the watch party is being able to jump into a group of people that are your friends or, you know, random strangers, if that's what you're into, and all just kind of enjoy something together without being physically near one another.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things I love about going to the theater is to watch things together. But I don't know. I think it'd be weird to do it remotely with strangers.
It's also, you know, this is a largely chat-based system. And they're, you know, in a country where we struggle to get people to accept that subtitles are okay, I don't know how many people are going to be cool with an active chat window while they're trying to watch something.
Okay, and that could just be interrupting you constantly.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it's something that's going to be kind of, you know, bumping, you know, flashing as you're going to watch. On the other hand, we have an entire generation of people who cannot sit on their couch without having their phone in their hand. So it, you know, there might be a way, depending on how Amazon deploys this, to have the video playing on a television and then the chat happening on your phone. And that way you don't have that kind of constant distraction unless you're signed up for it. You can kind of look down at your phone and see the chat as it's happening. It really just depends on how Amazon rolls this out. And we're going to see more of that later this week.
Why can't we just watch it together and chat on our phone anyway?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible. It's really just going to depend on how it gets rolled out.
So can you see whoever else is watching it on the screen watching with you or like in a Zoom chat?
It's not currently set up to work like a Zoom chat unless you're on a computer. So if you're on a phone, it's not gonna work that way. If you're on a computer and you want it set up that way, then it'll give you kind of that information.
And is it an extra charge yet, or do we know?
So far, it's not an extra charge. This is something that Twitch has already, kind of built in for certain things. I assume it's going to require everyone who is in the chat to have an Amazon subscription. It depends on how Amazon has this set up. Amazon may decide to roll out trial periods for people where, if you don't have an Amazon subscription but everyone else in the room does, then, you can get, five free movies, as long as you're with a friend or something. I'm sure that Amazon has several options there to try and get more people. Obviously, the big thing here is to show that there are more benefits to having a Prime subscription. So that people don't cancel it.
Right. I mean, who knows what Amazon will come up with next to get more subscribers.
That's right.
Kind of amazing. Okay. Fitbit has a new tracker, and you're liking it. It's called Fitbit Charge 4. Your reviewer called it a modest update, but what's different?
Yeah, so, I mean, the Fitbit design is something that pretty much everyone knows by looking down at it now. It's the tiny rectangle that sits on your wrist. There's a bunch of different wristbands that are available to it. And so, there was some concern that after Google had acquired Fitbit that would change a little bit because, Google's watches have more of a round design and have changed. This is kind of the last thing that Fitbit has designed without Google's influence. The Charge 4 is something that was designed beforehand and is being released now. And the biggest change is, kind of a real-time GPS tracker, which is something that Fitbit has struggled to put in a lot of its fitness trackers for a while because it ends up being a significant battery drain. To add GPS tracking in these devices are kind of small, sitting on your wrist. And having that kind of battery life that lasts for multiple days is something that Fitbit has been able to claim over Apple and Google for several years now. So losing that would be a disadvantage.
Uh-huh.
This is a modest update in that it really is very similar to the previous device, except it also has GPS tracking. But the other really significant benefit here is that it has that GPS tracking without really giving you any significant drain in battery.
So the GPS tracking, it's still not all the Apple Watches. It's just focused on health, movement, that kind of a thing.
It's definitely the same level of fitness tracker that an Apple Watch is, and it offers a lot of very similar features. If you want notifications from your phone to be delivered on your Fitbit, you can do that. If you want to use your Fitbit to pay for things when you're at a grocery store or a gas station, Fitbit has a payment system where you can, put your credit card into it and then just hold your wrist up to the payment terminal exactly the same way that you do an Apple Watch.
Wow.
There are a lot of features built into this thing, especially if you prefer to have just your watch. When you go on a run, if you like having your phone strapped to your arm or jangling around in your pocket, you can load songs onto the watch.
Wow.
And have it run like that. It really is the most the closest thing to an Apple Watch competitor that exists is this set of watches from Fitbit. The only difference really for most people is that it doesn't have as large a screen, and it doesn't really look like a watch. It very much looks like a Fitbit.
It still looks like a Fitbit. It shows an attractive black and white wristband, but you like more color, right?
I do, but the cool thing about the Fitbit watches is there have been so many different watch bands that you can get for them that are available on Amazon and all over the place. And Fitbit has been really friendly with third-party manufacturers for making those bands, unlike Apple. So you can get a replacement Fitbit band for like $12 on Amazon, and they come in so many different colors and styles. So that's, you know, what they launch with is usually fairly generic, but the options to add on to it are so numerous.
One of the cons in the pro and con list says there's an inconsistent Bluetooth connection.
That's right. Yeah. In the testing that was done, you know, you can connect to your watch if you want to use it as a media tracker for your phone. So if you have headphones in and you want to skip tracks or something like that, you can do it from your watch. And in doing that a bunch, there was some inconsistency in its use, you know, where it didn't always stay connected to the phone all the time. Instead, it would just connect when it needed to. And when you're trying to change tracks on your watch, it can be a little obnoxious to push a button and then wait for it to connect and then push a button again to make sure that it actually changes the track on the song that you're listening to. That sounds like kind of a weird thing to complain about, but when you're used to that happening kind of instantly with other watches, it's a noticeable flaw.
And limited smart functionality, is that a part of that?
Yeah, so the limited smart functionality really just comes from, you know, the Apple Watch allows you to get a text message, and you can reply to that text message from your watch, you know, through a couple different ways. You can use voice, you can, you know, trace an emoji on the screen, you can, you know, tap things out in kind of auto replies. And there's a lot of things like that. You know, if I want to look at the weather on my watch or something like that, it's really important to understand that I use my Apple Watch for everything but telling me time. And so the Fitbit is a really great fitness tracker that is still, you know, probably one generation behind the Apple Watch as far as available features for connecting to your smartphone and doing things like that.
All right. So getting back to the Google Apple plan to track COVID-19, one of the things they're talking about with that is creating an app that's in, you know, comes with the package when you buy it. And that you'd have to opt into it still. Do you think that the Fitbit is going to be part of that?
I think that the Fitbit will help give some health activities for tracking ways to remain healthy, but I don't think that the Fitbit itself is going to be a significant part of this. You know, the Bluetooth that comes from your phone is a big part of how the contact sharing mechanism is supposed to work. And it's always going to be stronger and more reliable than anything you're going to have on your wrist. You know, so when it comes to having an iPhone or an Android phone, Apple and Google are going to want to have that software live there instead of on your wrist.
You know, I'm wondering about your thoughts about how COVID-19 impacts technology development. Do you see it kind of spiraling off in different directions, a la this collaboration with Apple and Google?
We're definitely seeing things that you know, 5 months ago, I wouldn't have, you know, expected were likely. You know, a health collaboration between Apple and Google is certainly on that list, especially with how fiercely the two companies have been competing over the last couple of years in the health space. But also, you know, something we talked about last week, there are so many companies who are immediately rolling out these brand new features to make working from home so much easier. Mm-hmm. You know, I really think that the biggest change in technology, especially for companies, that we're going to see you know, by the time we're kind of, everyone says go back to normal, but by the time we're, you know, kind of, you know, able to wander around again without any significant hurdles, I think that the work from home technology is going to evolve to a point where there's going to be a huge part of the workforce that just doesn't need to go to an office anymore. That's just going to be, you know, that part's going to be normal for a lot of tech industries in particular.
Russell Holley, thanks for your time today. As always, appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's contributing editor at Android Central. He's with us just about every single week on Tech Tuesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.